Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 215 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, Laura Hurd speaks with Jeff Hattersley about her beginnings as a writer of bleak and gritty short stories, the real reason her first novel was written in four different voices, and how she gave her mother a literary afterlife in Dear Laura.
Laura Hurd was born in 1966 in Edinburgh, where, after many years in London, she now once again lives in the flat she was brought up in. Her writing was first noticed in Children of Albion Rovers, published in 1995, Kevin Williamson's anthology of prominent and emerging Scottish writers of the time, such as Irvine Welsh and Gordon Legge. Her first novel, Born Free, published in 1999, was shortlisted for both the Orange Prize and the Whitbread First Novel Award. This book and two collections of short stories, Nail and Other Stories, and Hope and Other Urban Tales, established her as one of Scotland's most exciting writers, able to create a whole range of authentic characters, young and old, male and female, who struggle to survive in an uncaring world. She has also published Dear Laura, a book based on letters written to her by her late mother, June Hurd.
Hello, Laura.
Hello, Jeff. Hi there. Nice to see you again.
Yeah, nice to see you again. It must be quite a while now.
Yes.
Since we did a reading together in Durham, I think, and maybe Newcastle. So you first came to notice, really, as a when you were including the Children of Albion Rovers anthology that Kevin Williamson did with, along with people like Irvine Welsh and Gordon Legge. That must have been an exciting time for you.
Yeah, it was great. The way that it happened was my friend at the time, her brother, wrote short stories, and I always enjoyed reading his short stories, and I went along to a reading. He was going to this reading, Rebel Inc., the magazine at the time. Must have been, I don't know, about 22 years ago. And I think Irvine Welsh was reading, you know, what became Trainspotting. It was just extracts that he'd had published in the magazine at the time. And I think Alan Warner was reading that night as well. And I went after work and I had on this a lamb's wool dress and this big coat and I fainted halfway through just with the heat. But I enjoyed it and, you know, the readings, just people talking about things that I understood about working class life, and it was all quite new to me. But I sent a story off to Kevin Williamson for the magazine, and I got a really sort of encouraging reply, and he published a couple of stories of mine in the magazine, and then he started doing an imprint of Rebel Inc. with Canongate Books, so I was asked to get involved with Children of Albion Rovers. So it was fantastic. It was great to have someone, no, luck to have someone so enthusiastic, sort of give me good feedback.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And he commissioned your first collection of stories, Nail.
Yes, yeah. And as I say it, it just feels so much like luck at that particular time. Or if I hadn't gone to that reading that night, would I have, you know, felt inspired to write a story and send it off? And would I ever have got round to writing stories?
Yeah, it must be great to get that kind of encouragement, rather than just sending them off and getting them kicked back by people you've never met and so on.
But the other thing with Kevin was when I sent him the story, he said, you know, write some more, and suggested other magazines to send them to as well, which was really helpful. And then I started to get, you know, to know all the literary magazines in Scotland and the north of England. And yeah, it was just a whole different world.
So Nail, it came out to quite some acclaim, really, and well, it's certainly a collection of hard-hitting stories, you know? Not for the faint-hearted, as one reviewer wrote. Did you deliberately set out to portray urban squalor?
Not particularly. I just wrote about things that I noticed, or I don't know. I don't know why it quite turned out so bleak. It was just the things that affected me or that I saw going on around me at the time. Always, you know, hearing snippets of conversation as you're walking along a street and thinking, you know, what happened to lead up to that and what happened after I walked past. And
right.
just have always liked writing and films that are about, you know, the underdog and are about lives that, you know, you don't ordinarily get to hear about.
I remember another story of yours called Destination Anywhere.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
About a photographer and who says, I depict urban squalor, poverty and misery or something. Mm. I don't do weddings and or pets and all that. Which I thought could almost have been you talking in a way, you know.
But the photographer in that's quite a horrible character himself. He's really quite full of himself.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's probably true that not many of your characters are all that sympathetic. Some of them are quite repellent, in fact. But even so, you still feel compassion for them, and however horrible they might be, you know, you still want to know what's happening to them. And I think that's quite a clever balancing act, how you do that, really. That you don't just make the reader despise these people, you make the reader ends up caring about them, you know, even if they don't actually like them much.
Well, I've always been fascinated with the, you know, the black and white of the human beings, and, you know, people who appear to be very nice can often have, you know, ulterior motives, and everyone's got a breaking point that's going to, you know, bring out a bad side in them, and just to, you know, get that balance. And then people might think don't have any good qualities, they do. They can be brought out by different events and different things happening to people they care about. So playing about with that, I've always enjoyed. And also, you know, particularly fascinated by the things I don't understand and putting myself into the head of people who behave in ways that I can't quite comprehend, but trying to think, well, why would they do that? And, you know, what could be the motivations for that? I find quite interesting.
So all these stories are just made up from your own imagination. You're sort of not basing them on any real events or things you've heard about? Or
I suppose there's little bits and pieces. As I say, overheard things at bus stops. And also, you know, sometimes there's a bit of revenge in stories. I find if you write about somebody that you know, they never seem to recognise themselves. But then other times people, particular subjects that people are sensitive about, and they'll think it's about them that you pick on a particular subject, but it's, you know, it's nothing to do with you. It's, I can't not write about a subject that everyone I know might have encountered.
Yeah. Do you usually start then with characters rather than a plot? You usually start with a person and then the story revolves around the person rather than you have the story and invent the person to fit that.
Sometimes I have an idea for a story, but then I do a lot of backstory on the characters and you know, try and, you know, work out where they come from, what their background is. I'd done some tutoring at the Arvon Foundation, which I always enjoyed. And one of the exercises I used to make the students do was these huge character studies. I would bark questions about the character at them. And I find it's a good way to just, when people have to just think on the spur of the moment, you know, someone's background, what political, what religion they were brought up with, you know, people they'd like to see again, people they'd hate to see again, and just by asking all these questions, I find you can get a plot can develop.
Yeah.
And talking about, you know, family relationships, and then like everything, I tend to overwrite and then sort of have to, you know, peel it all back.
Yeah, I think you've created an incredible range of characters as well. You're able to do young people, very young people, and old people, and both male and female as well. They're all equally believable, you know.
Well, it's good. As I say, being able to put yourself into all these people's different heads and think, well, what does it feel like to be them? And
yeah.
I've always been, you know, someone that observes people closely. I like, yeah. I'm sort of the quiet one in the room that's listening and watching and seeing what's going on. And I particularly like writing from the viewpoint of children. Just the different ways they see things and the things they don't see and the naivety and how they'll explain certain things. I've always enjoyed that.
Yeah, I found reading your stories featuring young characters reminds me of what it was like to be that age. You know, it's like I'd forgotten, really. I couldn't recreate youth like you do. It's sort of a grey area to me. I just recognise it when I read it. Yeah, I really were like that, wasn't I?
No. Well, it's hard. I think no matter what sort of upbringing you've had, if you've had a hard upbringing or if you've had a loving upbringing, there's these dark times in your childhood and these things that often nobody else gets to know about, you know, be it bullying or whatever, and the child has to carry that themselves. So I like to acknowledge that. The second last story I wrote was for the Creative Scotland website, and I wrote a story based on my, at the time, my friend's like 2-year-old son. I thought I want to do one from a really young child's point of view, and I enjoyed that, just the different language and the almost makes no sense, and it's about sibling rivalry between this 2-year-old and his younger brother, and I spent ages on that, but I loved it, and it's almost doesn't really make any sense, but I was just trying to be as convincing as I could be in this little boy's head.
So Rebel Inc, they also published your first novel, Born Free.
Yeah.
And that got some quite high acclaim at the time, you know, it was shortlisted for the Orange Prize, yeah? And,
it did okay.
Oh. I wondered about the way you structured it. You structured it as there are four main characters and each one gets a chapter to tell what's happening from their point of view, and that goes all through the book. I thought that were a great way of doing it. Did you actually write it that way? Did you write it in the sequence that appears in the book, or did you maybe concentrate on the characters one at a time and then mix them up later? I've always wondered how you'd done that.
Well, to be perfectly honest, I was commissioned to write Nail, and then it was quite soon after I was commissioned to write the novel, and I thought, I'd never, you know, in my wildest dreams, I had thought one day I'd like to write a novel, but yeah. I thought, oh God, I can't write a novel, what am I going to do? And that was originally why I had the four voices, because I thought, you know, I don't have the confidence as yet to, you know, carry a whole novel from one character's point of view. So it was just, so if one faltered slightly. And also I liked the idea of, you know, the kids going through adolescence at the same point that the parents are having a sort of middle-aged crisis.
Yeah.
And also liked the idea of, you know, some scenes are told from different characters' point of view and they see them differently. They can see what's going on differently, and I liked playing around with that.
And of course, it's a great portrayal of alcoholism, you know, on the part of the mother who has been clean for 3 years and then hits the bottle again.
Mm. At the time, I felt, particularly in Scottish writing, there was a lot of, you know, the males in Scottish writing, a lot of it was, you know, the hard-drinking, brutal man.
Yeah.
And in my experience, I hadn't really seen that. I'd grown up with strong women, not alcoholic women, but very strong women in my life. My father worked in a brewery and didn't drink, to have half a glass of wine and fall asleep. And he was very gentle, but, you know, not just within my family. I'd known some quite fierce women. And I thought, but you don't see that. It's always the men that are portrayed as brutes. So I wanted to sort of bring that through as well. And I enjoyed writing the sort of monstrous mother character. She was good fun, though. Probably not good fun for the person I was living at the time, because you do sort of go into character slightly when you're writing different chapters.
I remember reading somewhere that you were planning a sequel to Born Free, but I seem to have read that quite a long time ago, but nothing's happened.
Where did the years go? Yeah, Canongate, my publisher, commissioned a sequel just after the publication of Born Free, and you know, at the time I wrote the skeleton of the story and sample scenes of the story, and over the years I've been, you know, adding bits and sort of developing chapters, but I've just not sat and just put the whole thing together. Although my notes, I've got about 60,000 words worth of notes. But I recently got some funding from the Society of Authors, which I was going to use for the summer, but I got it after that. So I think in the winter I'm going to just get my head down and we'll spend a few months just trying to pull it all together. But because it takes so long to write things, particularly the sequel, which is terrible, I think if someone had commissioned you to build a kitchen for them and they paid you part of the money and 20 years later you're still waiting.
Right.
I have to get on with it.
So you're still writing short stories regularly?
Yeah.
It's often quite hard to find a market for short stories, though, which is a real shame, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Oh.
I think it's like the best genre, really.
Oh, I love
short stories to novels.
Me too.
And it's a pity that more people don't read them. But
I've never understood what the thing is with short stories, why people are so reluctant to engage with them. Even people that are voracious readers.
Yeah.
You know, and their favourite writers, like Stephen King, for example, he's written a couple of collections of short stories and they sell a fraction of his novels.
Yeah.
But most of the film adaptations of Stephen King are his short stories, but still yeah. his devoted readership can't bring themselves to read something shorter. I'd never quite got that. But I was lucky recently, Rapage at Comma Press asked me to get involved with a project which teamed writers with historians writing about the history of protest. So we were given a huge list of protests from the 13th century upwards to, you know, the Gulf War protest, Gulf War marches, Greenham Common, Section 28 marches. And I chose the 1820 Radical War in Glasgow, which I knew absolutely nothing about. I'd never heard of it. With a lot of the protests in the book, they're things that seems to have been erased from history, from the history books where, you know, the people in Britain have tried to rise up in one way or another, but yeah. it's not talked about. Reading the book from the start, it's fascinating and depressing too, because you see people have been struggling for the same reasons over hundreds of years. And on one hand, it's good, the human spirit, it won't get beaten down, it will keep trying. But on the other hand, it's, Jesus, are they still having to fight for these things, these basic human rights? And
yeah, and things are probably getting worse now rather than better. You know? So after Nail and Born Free and Hope, your third book, they were all very gritty, quite hard-hitting things. You followed that with a completely different book, Dear Laura,
yeah.
based on letters that your mother had written to you when you were a student. So how did that come about?
Well, initially I wanted to... You know, a lot of people, when I wrote Born Free, supposed that the mother in Born Free was somehow based on my own mother, and it couldn't have been further from the truth because, no. you know, I had a very loving upbringing, and I wanted to show that my mother wasn't like that. That wasn't my mother. But also, you know, my mother was a frustrated writer. She was a very creative woman. She was involved in acting when she was growing up, and her father wouldn't let her go to study at RADA because he said it was all, you know, a den of iniquity. But she would write bits and pieces and articles for the papers. And when I was a student, she used to write me these wonderful letters that all my friends and I would sit around and weep reading because we all felt homesick when I was studying down in London. And, you know, I wanted to share them, to give them a voice, because I always had shared them, and she liked the fact that my friends used to read them as well. And just to get some of her writing out there. Because after my mother died, I sort of didn't write for ages because it just seemed immoral to make up people when you realise you haven't spent enough time with the people that did love you or that you loved. You hadn't asked them the questions you wanted to ask them.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to express that in some way, and also included some of her writing that she'd had published in the newspapers and things.
Yeah, I only just read that book recently. I knew the other three books. And I would say I had very little idea of what you yourself were like as a person from those three books.
All right. Yeah.
So, and yeah, it's a completely different person that comes over in Dear Laura. You know, it's the autobiographical nature of it, you know. Means we see the real Laura Hurd in that one, as well as Jude Hurd too. And all this fantastic cast of characters that are coming in all the way through, with all the uncles and aunties and boyfriends who then disappear, and new boyfriends and so on.
I wanted to be as honest about myself in that book too, and put things in that really made me cringe about myself, because I thought, if I'm being honest with my mum's writing, then I've got to be honest about myself. I can't hide anything. And it was just good to get her out there. And I did an event at the Edinburgh Book Festival the year it was published. And it was, like, probably one of my highlights, except that she wasn't there and my dad wasn't there. But the doctors from the surgery she used to work in were there. And all these, you know, friends, the woman she used to work in, clean her house, she was there. And they all came along and I couldn't quite believe it.
And they all had read the book then?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Right. And I hadn't told them about it. They'd just heard about it by word of mouth, right. And they all came along. And I thought she'd have loved this. She would have absolutely loved this.
Yeah, I thought that one of the things that worked about the book was that you didn't try to... you portrayed yourself in quite a negative light, really, at the time. Mm. You know, you didn't try to gloss over your own behaviour or anything.
Well, it was a... And, must have been murder to live with. And all they were trying to do was, you know, love me. But I think, you know, people would be able to relate to that. And, you know, in your teens and early 20s, how selfish you can be. And how you can't see who's important.
Yeah.
You're too busy with your own things, your own selfish obsessions. And you don't realise till afterwards, you know, all the chances you've missed. And all the things you should have said.
So what's next on the horizon for you then? It seems quite a while since that book came out. So there's been a long silence from you in the publishing world.
Oh, yes, it has. Yeah. Well, I've run a website for several years, which just sort of like ended up taking up all my time. I think it was about 7 years I was running the website.
Right. Kind of like a magazine website, yeah.
Yeah, It started off... I used to tutor for the Arvon Foundation, and through that, discovering all these great new writers and giving them advice as to who they should send their work to. But then the frustration when some of them still didn't get published. So I just wanted a platform where I could showcase some of their work and get it out there. And then it just sort of grew, the website, and I was getting contributions from all over the world. And it was also literary magazines from around the world I was trying to publicise them, because, you know, they are so important.
So it was much like running a small magazine, really.
Yeah.
But without the paper and the postage costs.
Yeah.
And the mad trips to the post office with the bags full of magazines every time you brought an issue out.
Oh, yeah.
Probably a better way to do it, really.
Yeah, I loved doing that. I lost my bank card and the web hosting firm shut down the website. I tried to contact them to give them my new number, but they deleted the website, and I just really had to accept it. There was nothing I could do at that point. I had a lot of people reviewing for me as well, and, you know, they're still in touch, saying, you know, we'll be involved if you want to set it up again. But setting it up from scratch would be quite daunting.
So do you think you might... Have you given that up for good, or would you like to maybe start that again at some point? Or
I would love to do it again at some point, but just things have moved on so much with social media now, and a lot of the... I used to like interviewing people too, and not just writers and publishers, but people in my local pub. I did interviews with them in it, which I enjoyed, and half of the people I interviewed are no longer around. They're dead now. So it's sad that that's gone, these interviews, because a few of them, when they died, their relatives said, you know, that's the best tribute there was to them. That was exactly like Dad was, but that all went at the same time. It was just wiped out. But it's a shame I miss it. I also did a section on it, The Devil Has All the Best Tunes, where I would ask writers and people to think of a song that meant a lot to them and, you know, just have the story of the song. It was when I discovered YouTube, you know, that's how long ago it was. So I would have the actual song from YouTube and then the writer talking about memories of this song, which I really enjoyed, that section. I used to sit and, you know, read them all over and over again. Right. And a lot of the songs from that section, when I hear them today, I still think of what the contributor's story was based on. It's inflicted my memories of these particular songs.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing to do, you know. Why songs rather than, say, a favourite book or...
Just because they're so evocative and, you know, memories of certain songs, they'll always stay with you. Dan Fante, the writer, he wrote a fantastic piece about Little Richard's Lucille and the first time he heard it. And it was just reading the piece and then clicking and the song coming on, it's just, made my heart, you know, beat faster. But when I used to showcase the work, I'd, you know, have down the side, I'd ask the writers their favourite books, their favourite films and things, just to see what their influences were, which I found fascinating as well. And then discovering for myself new writing and new films and things.
Yeah.
It was an education for me.
Okay, well, it's been really nice to talk to you, Laura. And nice to see you again.
Yeah, you too.
And nice to be in the home where dear Laura took place, you know. So, thanks very much.
Well, thank you, Jeff. It's lovely, lovely to see you again. Lots of happy memories of Billy Lyre magazine.
That was Laura Hurd in conversation with Jeff Hattersley. You can find out more about Laura on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 215, which was recorded by Jeff Hattersley and produced by Conor McPhee. Coming up in episode 216, Donnie O'Rourke finds himself in the book-blessed town of Ullapool in May, celebrating the bonfires and bluebells of the Celtic Beltane Festival. Then Chris Arthur reflects on the inspirations of his odd object essays and considers the popularity of this particular form and the most important aspect of oddness within it. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.